From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's go right to major developments in Syria, where Syrian troops have entered the Kurdish-controlled northeastern part of the state for the first time in years to protect the Kurds. Now, last week, after President Trump decided to withdraw U.S. troops, Turkey immediately launched an assault on the Kurds who'd been fighting ISIS under the protection of U.S. troops. Now the Kurds have asked the Assad regime for help in fighting Turkey. So what does it mean that the U.S. is now out of the equation? There are fears that ISIS will rise again if the Kurds are now defending themselves instead of guarding ISIS prisoners. Arwa Damon, senior international correspondent for CNN, is on the Turkish-Syrian border. Arwa, what are you hearing on the ground?
Well, we are on a hill overlooking the Kurdish town of Ceylan Pınar, which is a border town that has all but cleared out, given that a few days ago, mortar rounds landed in it, killing two people. And it is quieter today than it has been, presumably because of the changing dynamics inside Syria. Look, all of this was pretty much brokered by the Russians in the sense that the Russians have significant levels of influence over both Damascus as well as Ankara. And now with the changing relationship between the regime and the Kurds, with the regime now moving north to retake control of the border, all of this that is playing out, especially in the last 24 hours, has really been a very complex, multidimensional game of political chess with, unfortunately, bloody and devastating consequences to the civilian population.
But, Arwa, I have to ask, if this is being brokered by the Russians, and today you said in some of your reporting that Russians, without firing a shot in the last couple of weeks, have essentially won Syria. But if they are, you know, friendly with both the Turkish leadership and with the Syrian regime, why would they send those troops towards each other?
Well, here's what a number of experts are telling us. The Turks could not have done this without some sort of an agreement from the Russians entering into Syria. That is, their move into Syria forced the Americans out. And in doing so, they basically did what the Russians and the regime have wanted all along, getting the Americans out of the way. And so what experts are telling us to look for is exactly where and how deep the Russians allow the Turks to move, in particular when it comes to key areas like Manbij and Kobani.
Arwa, we're hearing reports of U.S. troops who are still on the ground there in Syria, haven't left yet, who are, the words they're using are ashamed. We're ashamed that we're abandoning the Kurdish fighters who fought ISIS for us. We're hearing from the Kurdish fighters that they feel abandoned by the U.S. What are you hearing, you know, for instance, in Turkey?
Well, I mean, first of all, this is not the first time that a Western power has abandoned the Kurds. That tradition extends as far back as World War I, if not before. The fact that the Americans initially pulled back from the area that Turkey was intending to take over, that is what has really handed Russia this big win. And they're going to have a tough but not impossible job of negotiating the next phase of what is unfolding inside Syria.
Yeah. Well, what happens to the Kurds? We know that Turkey fears that the Kurds in Syria who've been fighting ISIS are tied to the Kurds who are a separatist group in Turkey. But what happens to these Kurds in Syria? Where do they go?
Well, right now, with the regime saying it's going to take on Turkey and at the very least take control of chunks of the border, that calculus changes for the Kurds because they are now in a position where even though they did enjoy all of this autonomy, they're going to have to bend the knee once again to a certain degree to the Syrian regime. And now the Americans are entirely not a part of the Syria playbook at this stage.
All right, well, one last quick question, because this is so confusing. We remember just a year ago, U.S. troops were backing up these Kurdish forces as they were fighting ISIS. When they were attacked by Syrian troops, along with Russian mercenaries who were fighting with the Syrian forces of the Assad regime. And we remember this, that U.S. troops had to, you know, beat back these Syrian and Russian fighters to protect the Kurds. And now, you're just a year later, you have Syria saying it will protect the Kurds when they were attacking them just a year ago. Why would Syria and Russia want to back the Kurds?
Look, it is very confusing. And those incidences that you're referring to, they were, it has to be said, fairly isolated. But in all of this, it's also worth remembering that the Kurds never fully cut their ties with the Syrian regime. What has happened now with this Turkish incursion is that the Kurds' strength has been significantly diminished because the one country they thought would not let them down because of everything that they'd sacrificed for it, America, actually has.
Arwa Damon, senior international correspondent for CNN on the Turkish-Syrian border. Arwa, as always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
To Texas now, where Fort Worth police shot and killed a black woman inside her own home over the weekend. They were responding to a non-emergency call by a neighbor who was worried because the woman's door was open. The family's lawyer says Tatiana Jefferson was playing video games with her nephew when she was killed. Christopher Connolly from member station KERA joins us now from Fort Worth. Chris, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
So it was early Sunday morning around 2:30. Tatiana Jefferson at home with her nephew. A neighbor called police. There is body cam evidence here, so investigators will be going through that. But what else do we know about what happened next?
They were responding to a welfare call from a neighbor who had been concerned that the doors were open at her house. And so they were going around, and you can actually see in the body camera evidence that's been released, you can see the police officer going around, checking out the house with his flashlight and going around to the back. Very quickly, he shifts up and looks at the window and sees her there, tells her to put up her hands, and then shoots.
Yeah, and he does not announce himself as a police officer. Also, some more context here is that this is the seventh time since June 1st that Fort Worth police have shot a civilian. Six of those people have died. What are police saying about this?
The police are saying that they're moving swiftly with the investigation. I mean, they're calling the Fort Worth Police Association, the police union has called the circumstances pretty heartbreaking. But so far, they haven't released a ton of information about exactly what might happen to the officer or how they're viewing it, or if this will be turned over to the district attorney's office for a criminal investigation.
The department did release a statement that said the officer was perceiving a threat and that the officers found a firearm, a gun, when they entered the home, but not that Jefferson was holding the gun at the time of the police shooting. They also released a photo of it in the house. But here's the family's lawyer, S. Lee Merritt, yesterday saying he wanted to dispel any negative image that police might be trying to paint of her.
On the night that she was killed, she was playing Halo with her 8-year-old nephew, Zion. This was her great joy, spending time with her family. This is how she spent her life.
A lot of people have guns legally in their homes in Texas and around the country, and they have the right to use it if they perceive a threat inside their own home. What kind of unanswered questions are there on this issue?
Well, the number one is, you know, did she have the gun in her hand? Police haven't been able to say whether or not she did. As you point out, Texas is a state where lots of people own guns. It's an open carry state. You know, she was in her home in the middle of the night. So if she had a gun when she heard something rustling around in the back, it may not be totally unbelievable that she would have reached for the gun or had the gun with her while she was going to investigate. But, you know, none of that is known quite yet. And police really haven't been able to clarify, you know, why they released the photograph of the gun in their initial sort of statements on the shooting.
Well, people are learning about this case and drawing comparisons to the case of Botham Jean, who was shot and killed by a white Dallas police officer inside of his home. That officer, Amber Geiger, was just sentenced to 10 years in prison. What are you hearing? Are people drawing any comparisons to these two stories?
Absolutely. I went to a vigil last night, actually at a mosque right next door to the house where Tatiana Jefferson was killed. And there were a couple hundred people there, at least, most of them African-American. there was a lot of shock, a lot of sadness, but also just a lot of anger and people saying that they don't feel safe calling the police. They say this is another incident that sort of shakes any kind of trust the African-American community has in police departments, and that this is a larger issue than just each individual shooting, that there's a larger sort of systemic problem when it comes to policing in America, is what a lot of the activists were saying. And they, you know, many of them also pointed to, you know, not just Botham Jean, who was killed in his own home, and a Tatiana Jefferson, who was killed in her own home, but this recent series of police shootings in Fort Worth as well.
Well, in fact, the neighbor who called the police over the weekend was telling TV News that if he hadn't called, she would still be alive today. That was Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth, Texas, with member station KERA. Chris, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
A hospital in Denver is trying something new to solve an expensive problem. Poor patients are often stranded in their hospital rooms long after they could have been discharged. But if they have nowhere to go, they have to stay in the hospital, sometimes for a very long time. Now Denver Health, along with the Denver Housing Authority, is building new homes for these patients. Peg Burnett is the hospital's chief financial officer. Peg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And can you first explain, who are these stranded patients? We heard Kaiser Health News report in the Denver Post recently that one stayed for more than 1,500 days. How could that be?
That's right, that one of our patients did stay more than 1,500 days. When people come to a hospital, obviously they have something that we need to treat in the hospital, but then they get better and then we need to do a discharge plan for them. And that's the case under Medicare conditions of participation. So one of the requirements is that we have to have a safe discharge for them. And that's where we run into roadblocks sometimes. The patient might be homeless. They might have a home, but it's uninhabitable for some reason. Hmm. They might not really have a stable home, might be just staying at someone's home temporarily. So homelessness and lack of a safe home, that's just one aspect of the lack of safe discharge issue. There are others.
But they would have no medical reason to stay in the hospital, even though they could for several months longer than they would have normally.
That's right. They have no medical reason to stay in the hospital, and they no longer need hospital care, but they do need some follow-up care. They might need home health services, or they might need oxygen or ongoing IV antibiotics. Normally, if you can go home, you can have home health come and visit you. You can have physical therapy, occupational therapy come to your home. But because these people lack housing, that can't happen. And so that's the category of patients that we're working with right now to look to start providing some temporary housing while they take care of their medical needs.
And we'll talk about that project in a minute. But first, how much of a burden do those patients, or really non-patients, cause for not only the hospital financially, but for other people who do need care?
Yes, it's a significant burden. And we track the data on all of our patients who are in the hospital, but could be somewhere else. So that includes those who are homeless, and also those who could be in a nursing facility, for example. The total on that is that at any given time, we have between 25 and 30 patients in the hospital that could be somewhere else. And that's out of our census of average of 322. So that's significant. Our cost per day is about $2,700. We do have some sources of funds that help offset. I estimate that in 2018, we incurred cost of about $28 million related to these folks that we can't find placement for.
Wow. So to address this problem, you have the idea of building housing on the campus. Tell me how that would work. I guess your calculations show that it would be cheaper to house them in a different building than take care of them in the hospital?
Yes, that's right. The bottom line on the cost of housing in the new building is going to be about $10,000 a year versus $2,700 a day. So that's pretty easy math.
Wow.
So the project that we're working with the Denver Housing Authority on, it's going to be senior low-income housing units, and it's going to be the Denver Housing Authority's typical model for those. But Denver Health is going to lease a floor in that building. It's going to be 15 units. And so we're starting out relatively small because, as you noted, this is new. This is something that hospitals are just now getting into and haven't done before. We want to see how it works. So we're starting with the 15 units, and we'll gauge the success of those and then perhaps expand the program.
And what kind of services will they get while they're there?
They'll be in their independent housing, and then we will provide some case management services to help them with the follow-up medical services they need. So, for example, they might need outpatient appointments with their doctor. They might need home health. They might need oxygen, physical therapy. Denver Health won't necessarily be providing those medical services, but we will help coordinate the services.
This is not just a problem in Denver. It's kind of happening all over the country. What kind of conversations are your colleagues in other places having about this?
That's right. And we're aware of other organizations that are getting involved. There's a recent Journal of American Medical Association article that talked a little bit about Kaiser Permanente, the University of Illinois Hospital in Chicago, and some other systems that are getting involved in this. But it is a growing problem across the country. And what I've been saying is it's not just Denver Health's problem. It's a community problem. The patients are in our hospital because of laws and regulations. But our responsibility is to provide care and then find a place for them to go where they have the next level of appropriate care. We need other partners to help solve the issue.
Well, exactly. That was my last question to you. Is this really the hospital's problem to fix? It sounds like maybe there's a systemic problem involved that the government should be stepping in to solve.
I think that the government can assist. I think that the business community can assist us with this. And a number of partners in the community need to come together to help with this issue.
Peg Burnett is Chief Financial Officer for Denver Health, which is building affordable housing units on the hospital campus. Peg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And our next story comes from neighboring Wyoming, but it could be from just about anywhere in rural America. Millions of Americans outside of cities don't have reliable high-speed internet, and that is especially true for many on tribal reservations. In the last few years, the Eastern Shoshone and the Northern Arapaho tribes have been laying fiber optic cables to bring faster internet to the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
It's dumping rain the day Patrick Lawson gives me a tour around Wind River Internet's warehouse. Through an open garage door, you can see giant orange spools of fiber optics lines.
These are the markers that you'll see around the reservation and in Riverton.
But you'll see the little tribal logo on there, and it says warning fiber optic cable, and that means if you see that, you can probably get internet from us.
Lawson is the head IT guy for the entire Northern Arapaho tribe. And that's saying something because the tribe is one of only 14 in the country that is its own telecommunications carrier. About a decade ago, the tribe started this business to offer its members wireless internet because none of the other big telecommunications carriers would.
It's not appealing to other providers to come in and go to individual residence homes. Usually what they do is they come in and they go to just like the schools or clinics or you know, the places with the bigger pockets. And they kind of leave the others behind.
The tribe is more than 10,000 strong, spread across 1.8 million acres in central Wyoming. So getting internet to each and every home is daunting. But that's exactly what the Northern Arapaho plan to do in the next 10 years. Lawson shows me a map of the reservation.
All those little purple dots or houses are homes passed, so we're running a dedicated fiber optic cable past every single one of those homes.
Lawson says this could help the tribe in so many ways. Help entrepreneurs sell their wares on a global market or put a doctor right in someone's home. That could help reduce health disparities on Wind River, where the life expectancy is only 54 years old for the general population.
We could have a Denver person operating on somebody in Riverton. Instead of transporting the patient to Denver, they could do it remotely, which I think would be amazing.
High-speed internet could also put teachers in people's homes, and distance learning is something Central Wyoming College in Riverton is anxious to offer. Vice President of Student Affairs Coralina Daly says tribal students often struggle to make it to class.
You know, sometimes it can be 15 people that are relying on the same vehicle, and if somebody has to go to a medical appointment in Billings, you're not coming to class that day. And so it's really a heartbreak when it's that's what gets in the way.
Daly says if those students could access class from a computer screen, more students would succeed. But there are some hurdles to bringing fiber optics to the reservation.
Telephone companies typically do not know how to interact or interface with the tribal governments and thus decide to build around.
That's Talawa tribal member Forrest James. He's CEO of EnerTribe, an organization that mediates with tribal governments on economic development projects like these. He says he's seen that fiber optics is a lifeline for Native communities.
Now they have tribal members moving back to the reservation because they can actually continue their education right there at home. I think one of the biggest challenges that we have in Indian country is getting our membership, getting our citizens to come back home, to be able to offer them jobs if they do, and to be able to keep them.
James is working with the tribes and Union Wireless, a family-owned carrier serving parts of the Mountain West. He says he's gotten a lot of fiber optics projects off the ground, but this has been truly unique.
The idea of a public-private partnership between two tribal governments and a local telephone company, of which the local telephone company is paying for the infrastructure, it is almost unheard of and such a wonderful example that I want to duplicate it.
But that could be quite an undertaking. 39% of rural America lacks access to high-speed internet. In urban America, it's only 4%. The projects on Wind River could be a good template for connecting homes across the West. For Wind River Internet's Patrick Lawson, his goal isn't just to be on par with the reservation's neighboring communities.
That's not good enough. If it's only just a little bit more to increase things from, you know, 10 times better to being 100 times better, let's aim for that 100 times better and ask, why not aren't we doing something that's 1,000 times better?
Construction on the two projects is expected to start next spring. For Here and Now, I'm Melody Edwards on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
The Trump administration's withdrawal from northern Syria has forced Kurdish fighters there into an unexpected alliance with the Syrian regime. And the White House decision to remove U.S. troops is provoking criticism from Republicans and Democrats in Congress as a new week begins on Capitol Hill. Also today, President Trump's former top Russia advisor Fiona Hill is testifying as part of the impeachment inquiry. Hill joined the Trump administration in 2017, but left a week before the president's now infamous July phone call to Ukraine's president. NPR political reporter Tim Mak joins us now from Capitol Hill. Tim, hello.
Hi there.
And let's start with Syria. Congress officially returns from recess tomorrow, but it has not stopped Republicans and Democrats from strongly calling out the administration's retreat from northern Syria. What more can you tell us about how Congress is responding today?
Well, it's a really interesting situation because it appears that even as the specter of a possible impeachment proceeding hangs over the president, he is taking actions that are alienating what are normally his strongest supporters, Republicans in the Senate. So Republicans are speaking out like they rarely do in order to criticize this withdrawal from Syria and the resulting violence that has come after this decision was made by the White House. There's going to be bipartisan pushback on this. We've heard that there are outlines already emerging of bipartisan sanctions against Turkey. Perhaps a resolution of disapproval could come up in the Senate floor. We don't have the exact decision as to how this is going to go, but Republicans do seem eager to speak out on this issue. You know, Senator Lindsey Graham, he's a Republican of South Carolina. He's normally a very close ally of the president, but he's been also one of the most vocal in pushing back against this policy, saying that, you know, quote, we are witnessing ethnic cleansing in Syria. He also says that the emergence of ISIS is possible as a result of these actions by the Trump administration.
Well, as you say, the issue of impeachment is also front and center. The president's former Russia advisor Fiona Hill is testifying behind closed doors today. Again, she left the administration just before Trump's phone call to the president of Ukraine on July 25th. What insight do you think she can bring to this inquiry?
Well, like you say, you know, Fiona Hill stepped down from her post on the National Security Council just days before this now famous July phone call between the president and the leader of Ukraine. She's a foreign policy expert, specializes in Russia. So because she stepped down before this phone call, she obviously can't discuss the phone call, but she can discuss the context, what led up to it. She's expected to discuss the ouster of former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, whose abrupt removal has become a central part of this impeachment inquiry. And she's also expected to testify about her view that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, was operating kind of a shadow foreign policy, a Ukraine policy, separate and apart from the National Security Council. So she's appearing today after receiving a congressional subpoena, and her interview is expected to last throughout the rest of the day.
Tim, quickly, there was also news over the weekend that former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, said he would step down from the board of a Chinese company. And Joe Biden said no one in his family would be involved in any foreign operation whatsoever if elected. What more can you tell us about that?
Well, this is part of what the Biden campaign is trying to do to get ahead of some of these allegations the president is pushing forward. Joe Biden and his campaign have been trying to say, look, there is going to be no one associated with my administration, yep, if I'm elected president, that works for a foreign company.
And we'll leave it right there. NPR's Tim Mak.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, every year about 2 million Americans get infections that are resistant to drugs, and about 23,000 of them die. Recently, we spoke to a medical editor at The Economist who said that while climate change is one of the world's most pressing concerns, solving it won't matter if we can't solve the problem of antibiotic drug resistance. Among the most common, we've reported on this, urinary tract infections, UTIs, about 60% of women will get them and many won't get the right drug that will work for them. And lower respiratory tract infections, sometimes treated with 5 or more drugs before an effective one is prescribed. Well, a new diagnostic tool that helps fight drug resistance by more quickly and accurately identifying bacteria might help. Evan Jones is CEO of OpGen, which has created this technology. He joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
And elaborate on this idea that we are growing resistant to many antibiotics.
It's a huge and growing problem. If you take a step back and just think about what's happened, antibiotics were first discovered around World War II. Before World War II, if you had an infection, you often lost a limb or died. Mm-hmm. That set the table for huge medical advances over the last 70 years, and a lot of them are at risk now. As antibiotics have been used, resistance is rising. And in this decade, particularly in areas like urinary tract infections, the rates of increase of resistance can be up in the 30% per year rate. Mm-hmm. So that sets the table for some of these problems that we're talking about.
Well, it's largely because bacteria is a living thing, and it's smart, and it can learn how to resist the antibiotic that you give it. And so what happens, let's take UTIs, and they happen more for women, far more for women than for men, and they can be excruciatingly painful. When you go to an emergency room, let's say, with this pain, you might take a test, you might take a, you know, give a sample of your urine. What is the problem with that existing technology?
Well, there's about 10 million cases a year of people with UTI infections, and for the vast majority of them, about 8 million a year, you can probably treat them safely with what they call empiric therapy. So you have an idea of what antibiotics will work for that group of patients, and you simply prescribe in advance of having a confirmatory diagnostic result.
Empiric. You ask
empiric.
A set of questions and you conclude this is going to be the solution for you. And you,
exactly.
You give the, I mean, there's, you know, one or two that have been very, very popular, and you prescribe one of those.
Right. Mm-hmm. But if you are of the 2 million that have something more complicated, the remaining 20 or 30%, if you tried that empiric approach, you would have given them the wrong medicine. They'd be resistant to it.
Yeah, which is, again, excruciating. If you've taken a course of antibiotics and at the end of it, you still have painful symptoms of this and now a growing urinary tract infection, just very frustrating. Also, it's not good to keep taking antibiotics and you're about to go on your second course. So what's wrong, though, with the existing screening test? Let's move to that. You also can take a urine sample or a culture and look more closely at the bacteria and decide which bacteria it is and which pill would be best.
Well, the challenge is a woman or man is presenting in the emergency room. Oftentimes, they are just before transitioning into sepsis or they have other comorbidities. So
wait, sepsis? Explain.
Sure. Well, almost everyone knows someone who's had a urinary tract infection that progressed into the kidney, then went from the kidneys up into the bloodstream. So this is an early stage of an infection that can become much more serious. So it's critical to treat these patients correctly. And we did a large outcome study with an integrated healthcare delivery network that showed that for every day the patient was on the wrong antibiotic, that could translate to up to 2 days' length of stay in the hospital. So in this facility, it took 3 days to get the right decision. That would be 6 extra days of hospitalization.
Well, and that's because it takes a long time. Let's say you take the culture. It sometimes takes a long time for that culture to grow and for you to test what bacteria it is.
Exactly. And the more resistant the pathogen, the more complicated the testing needs to be. So, you know, in the simple case, they can oftentimes give you the result in a day or two. But if it's a multi-drug resistant pathogen, that testing can take another 2 to 3 days.
Talk about what your device, your technology would do.
Well, we've developed a test and informatics to interpret the results. They give the correct information in about 2 to 3 hours compared to 2 to 3 days. And it looks at the DNA of the microbes. It's direct from the urine sample. And we'll tell the physician what's the level of the microbe, what microbe is it. And then we look at the antibiotic resistance genes, upload that data to the cloud, and give a report that says, okay, here's the antibiotics that this patient's likely to be susceptible to, and here are the ones that we predict resistance.
Are you saying that normal urine tests don't look at the DNA of a bacteria?
No, they don't.
Will this technology be applicable to other infections?
Yes, it'll be applicable really across the board of acute care infections. Our next area of focus is lower respiratory tract infections. The data suggests that up to 50% of those specimens, the classic microbiology, is ineffective. Mm. And so it's ripe for need of rapid couple of hour DNA tests that can tell you what pathogens there, what's the right antibiotic. And this area of lower respiratory infections is one where patients are getting a lot of overtreatment. If you present yourself in an emergency room and they, let's just say you have acute pneumonia, they could treat you with up to 5 antibiotics and antifungals before they know what you have. And of course, usually you only need one of those. So you can see that it's costing the system a lot of money. It creates more resistance and it damages the patient.
Well, but on the other hand, urine dipsticks were considered a modern-day miracle. What has to happen to make your technology that available? Because I'm presuming right now, it's not.
Right. We've been working for several years on this and recently completed a large outcome study with 3 large healthcare systems and showed that this new technology is about 90% accurate in terms of making the antibiotic predictions and even more accurate in saying, yes, you have an UTI that needs treatment right away.
Is this being used?
The way the U.S. system works is it can be used only for research purposes in advance of FDA clearance.
Are you in the pipeline?
We are in the pipeline. We have begun our clinical trials. A early version of the test is pending in front of FDA, and then that will be followed by clearance, hopefully, of the information technology we call the Lighthouse that interprets the genomic test result.
Look, you are in a for-profit enterprise, but also you're on the forefront of this awareness of drug-resistant bacteria. Do you share the same alarm that, let's say, the editor of The Economist did, and in that there are problems enough right now with drug-resistant bacteria, but on the horizon, we have a changing climate that is negatively impacting a lot of things, including, heat, for instance, something that bacteria loves to grow in. Are you also alarmed about a future with drug-resistant bacteria combined with climate change?
First of all, I'm pretty optimistic that our technology can solve these problems, the combination of rapid precision medicine diagnostics combined with new drug discovery. Having said that, there's so much inertia in the healthcare system that translating that into action and change has got to happen quickly. This affects people's lives, millions of people each year.
Evan Jones is CEO of OpGen, developing a diagnostic tool that will pinpoint which bacteria are causing UTIs, in part by taking a look at their DNA. Evan, thanks so much. We'll stay in touch with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, in addition to technology, researchers agree that new drugs are needed to fight bacteria that's resistant to existing drugs. But the problem is there's little economic incentive for companies to develop new drugs. Because remember, the goal is to use them as infrequently as possible so that bacteria don't learn to be resistant. And that means low sales. Well, a new report from researchers from the University of Pittsburgh confirms that. It says a new antibiotic effective against the so-called nightmare bacteria, CRE, is making only about $100 million a year, but that's well below the $1 billion per year sales figure economists say is necessary to keep a drug on the market. One of the five companies producing the drug has filed for bankruptcy. The researchers say that without new and sustained financial incentives for biopharmaceutical companies, it's unlikely they'll develop and sustain new critical drugs. So for now, they say educating doctors about when and how to use antibiotics, not a lot, will help. How many times have you been in a funeral and thought, why didn't we do this before our friend died? Why didn't we tell them these things? Well, people are now doing just that with living funerals or memorials. Remember the saying, go ahead, it's your funeral? Well, a living funeral really is. New York-based writer Mary Elizabeth Williams wants to do it if she gets the advance notice many terminally ill people do. She's written a book about her own brush with death and cancer. It's called A Series of Catastrophes and Miracles, A True Story of Love, Science, and Cancer. And her recent New Yorker article was titled, Have Your Funeral Before You Die. Mary Elizabeth, this all started after your friend Jessica had a living funeral. What was it like?
It was amazing. As you point out, how many times do we go to a memorial and say, oh, she would have loved this? And if you feel that way, then you can start making these kinds of plans. My friend Jessica was an inspiration to me in so many ways. We met in a cancer support group, and our lives took different paths. I got better. She did not. But when she was approaching the end, she made a very conscious decision that she wanted to have a celebration of life party. And it was one of the most moving, profound, sad experiences of my life.
It sounds fascinating, but, you know, this idea that somebody is, you know, dying, most people can't accept that, especially if you are battling cancer. And you write about this, that it's, you know, it's cast as a battle that you must win. And having that acknowledgement that you are going to leave, some people can't go there.
Absolutely. As you point out, we use the words battling to describe illness. And when someone dies, we say they lost their battle. And if we are all in a battle against mortality, then we are all losers, right? Mm-hmm. When I was very, very sick, I was scared out of my mind and I wanted to live. But what I also know is that when we are approaching the end, if we can do it with as much dignity and compassion for the people who are not going with us— You know, I very clearly remember Jessica saying to me, it's going to hurt and it's going to be hard and then it's going to be okay. And that meant everything in the world to me.
Mm-hmm. But I can still hear people thinking, when you are that sick, that enormous amount of affection coming at you, it sort of requires the person who is dying to help other people grieve when they may barely be able to stand up.
There's no right way to die. Right? Many of us don't have the privilege of being able to face it with our full faculties and right. with full agency. From my own experience as a patient and as a caregiver and as someone who grieves, any time that you can do something for someone else in this world, it feels good. Even at your most vulnerable and fragile, you still have purpose. And if that purpose is to give comfort to the grieving, that is an incredible, incredible thing to do.
How did Jessica feel after having done it?
I know it was what she wanted. It was at the home of a Broadway composer, and we sat around the piano and sang Space Oddity. And I get chills just thinking about it.
Yeah, you're guaranteed, if you have a living funeral, everyone does exactly what you want.
Right?
Yeah.
I know. It's wild. My friend Debbie, when she died, she unfortunately was another big factor for me was that her funeral did not go the way that she had wanted it to go. And there was someone who really kind of imposed his own will on it. I think when you're in the room, it's a lot harder to pull that kind of nonsense. You have to be a lot more accountable when the person's still alive.
Well, and you say you plan on doing this if you have the chance that Jessica had. You met in the cancer group, as you said, she with ovarian cancer, you with stage 4 melanoma. Just take a second to talk about that, because you write about you were sitting in a waiting room at Memorial Sloan Kettering doing some of your treatment when you read two words that changed your life, immune cells. You were eligible for a clinical trial, had two immunotherapy drugs. They positively and radically affected your treatment. And yet, I'm wondering if, you know, this is so much more present a thought for you than it might be for other people.
Yeah. I mean, I won the cancer lottery. Mm-hmm. Absolute, for sure. I was at the right hospital at the right time when a future Nobel Prize winner, Dr. James Allison, was heading up a clinical trial. And what it comes down to is science, genes, and luck and insurance. And I'm here, and I absolutely know that it's not because I was better or stronger or prayed harder than anybody else.
Having looked over your own cliff and really had to, you know, face your own mortality, and also seeing your friend Jessica, it sounds like, gracefully and graciously have a living funeral, do you find yourself maybe daydreaming about yours, which is further off than it was? Do you find yourself thinking about what you'd like? What would you like?
I would love to have, like, photographs. I would love for there to be really good food, even if I myself would not be able to partake in it. Mm-hmm. I would definitely want there to be as much laughter and silliness as possible, because that is how I try to live my life.
That's writer Mary Elizabeth Williams. She writes for Salon, The New York Times, other publications, has also written a book, A Series of Catastrophes and Miracles, about her experiences with cancer. And she's been talking about living funerals, one that will take place before she goes. Mary Elizabeth, we hope it's way down the road and you have a blast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so I have a funeral folder, but a living funeral. We want listeners' thoughts. Have you been to one? Are you planning one? Weigh in, hereandnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.